This is Paul Moss in Ghana with a special programme for BBC World Service, Ebola, the impact on Africa. Over the next hour, we'll be hearing from people affected by the disease from across West Africa. From the Nigerian who lost his wife to Ebola and then contracted the disease himself. From people who face losing their livelihoods because of Ebola, like hotel workers in Senegal, where tourists have mostly stopped coming, despite the country being officially declared Ebola-free. And we'll also hear how Ebola has damaged agriculture in this region, risking food shortages in the near future. And there'll be the views of West Africa's music megastar, Baba Maal.
Most of these countries who are affected by Ebola are left on their own so far. I didn't hear that sending doctors and things from the African countries. I didn't hear that yet. Maybe I'm wrong, but I would have liked to see that.
Here in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, I've come to a meeting of local charities, churches and trade unionists who've banded together to help send relief to victims of Ebola in stricken countries. Accra is the headquarters for the United Nations mission to tackle Ebola. It's from here that the flights take off, bringing medical supplies and some medical personnel to Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone. But the people meeting here at the headquarters of Ghana's Trade Union Congress believe that the people of West Africa, indeed the people of Africa generally, must also play a role in fighting Ebola and the havoc it's wreaked.
My name is Clara Osei-Boateng. Survivors of Ebola are advised to destroy their personal effects like clothing. Some even go to the extent of destroying their houses because they believe that the virus has come into contact with certain substances or things in the house, that if you do touch them again, there's the possibility of reinfection or the chances that, somebody else reinfected. So like to stop the spread of the virus, people are asked to destroy their personal effects. So we think that in solidarity with our sisters and brothers in Liberia, Sierra Leone, in Guinea, we want to mobilize civil society in Ghana to organize and send some relief items.
There is a huge international effort to help the Ebola-stricken countries from the United Nations, from individual member countries in the West. Why was it so important for you that a Ghanaian organization like yours should get involved?
Civil society is quite strong in Ghana compared to other countries like Togo or Benin or anywhere else. I think we are in a better position to mobilize to support. I think it's important that as Africans we learn how to solve African problems as well. The international community is there, but we can't always rely on the international community for everything.
There's also a regional issue here, isn't there? Because there have been efforts to create a sense of West African unity. Do you think we've really seen much of that in tackling Ebola?
I haven't seen that much of West African identity. I think the initial reaction has been each country trying to protect itself against the spread of Ebola, which is why we as civil society, we want to take that initiative, bring other people on board, bring other organizations on board, so then together we can respond to this crisis.
Clara Osei-Boateng. It's strange to think of that river in the far north of Congo, once so obscure, but with a name now known across the world, because it was near the river Ebola that the first incidence of the disease was reported back in 1976. And once the virus was identified, it was the Ebola that provided its name. There are plenty of diseases currently killing more people than Ebola, malaria, for example. And there are others which can be easier to catch, like measles. But it's Ebola, which is now seen as representing the biggest international medical emergency, perhaps since AIDS first appeared in the 1980s. And for good reason. Unlike malaria, there's no proven remedy for Ebola. Unlike measles, there's no vaccine, although some will soon be undergoing trials. And then there's the fact that death from Ebola is so horribly gruesome. Left untreated, victims suffer internal and then external bleeding before fever, dehydration and then major organ failure bring them to a rapid and painful death. There have been apocalyptic predictions of perhaps a million Ebola cases by the beginning of next year, of societies breaking down in the face of such devastation. One man who's experienced his own personal devastation from Ebola is Dennis Akar. His fiancée was a nurse on her first day at work in Lagos, Nigeria, when the hospital admitted an Ebola patient he'd flown in from Liberia. Dennis's fiancée was then exposed to the virus on the hospital ward. Speaking to me from Lagos, Dennis told me what happened after that.
On the 21st of July, she got infected. Because she was 2 months pregnant, she had been having morning sickness, so we couldn't detect if it was Ebola or not. But 14 days after, she broke down. I looked after her, then I took her to the isolation center. I did a lot of things just to make her stable, but at the end of the day, I lost her. She died.
And how long after she died were you aware that you might have contracted Ebola as well?
2 days after she died, I started having my own symptoms. My temperature rose from 34.5 to 37 degrees centigrade, from 37 to 39 degrees centigrade. That was the highest I got. After that, I started having the body pains and the joint pains. It was not normal. It was not normal compared to other fever I'd had in the past, maybe like malaria fever. So it wasn't normal. So at that point, I knew I had Ebola. And a lot of persons were actually running away from me. So I couldn't even buy anything in my street. So I had to go far away from my house just to eat, for me to eat. And after eating, I came back to my house. I don't want anybody to come close to me. And I was able to manage it myself.
But could you take care of yourself when you were in that condition?
I could do it. But the Lagos State Ministry of Health, in charge of the Ebola outbreak, they called me. So when they found out that my temperature has rose, they had no choice than to come and pick me up in the house. So I went to the isolation center here in Lagos. At first, I was scared. In the same ward, some of them were vomiting. A lot of things were happening to them. Physically, you know they're not okay. But for me, physically, I was okay because I came in early. I came in early. You know, that was what helped me. So physically, I was okay compared with other persons that was in the ward with me.
You're saying you were okay physically. How are you feeling in yourself to be surrounded by this kind of suffering?
No, within myself, I was dying, but I had to encourage myself. You can imagine when you're seeing death in the face, but I had this belief and this hope that I wasn't going to die. Those people I was with, some of them, I ended up speaking with them, letting them know they're not going to die. Ebola is not a death sentence. That was what I was saying to myself.
So you recovered from Ebola, you survived, and I gather you're now devoting yourself to helping others who get the disease and to prevent the disease spreading.
Yes. After I came out, I'm actually working on an initiative. So the objective of that initiative is to make sure that people are educated, they are informed. Most people don't know their calling or their purpose in life until a tragic event happens to you. God has given me a second chance to affect the lives of other persons.
Dennis Akar, speaking to me from Lagos, Nigeria. It's been said many times that Ebola is a disease of poverty. Those cases that broke out in the US and Spain were isolated fairly quickly. No serious fear of epidemic in Washington or Madrid. But Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea all suffer from poor medical infrastructure, poor infrastructure generally. It's important to tell people always to wash their hands, but that may not always be so easy if water isn't flowing from a tap. Indeed, public health messages themselves can be harder to convey. Radio and television can play a role, but leaflets and posters have limited effect where literacy itself is limited. And here Ebola is having a truly pernicious effect, because not only does it spread because of poverty, Ebola also further impoverishes those countries where it strikes, a vicious circle of medical decline. The World Bank warned this week that the disease will cost West Africa several billion dollars. That's not quite as much as their previous estimate. But the bank's chief economist for Africa, Francisco Ferreira, made it clear that the three countries where Ebola remains still risk suffering serious damage to their national finances.
We are saying that given that Nigeria and Senegal were so successful in containing the epidemic, we feel now that the risk of that very high case is a bit lower. It's still a very high dangerous case, and we need to be very careful. There's absolutely no room for complacency.
He mentions Senegal there, and Senegal has indeed managed to contain Ebola. The country had just one case back in August, a man who managed to enter the country from neighbouring Guinea. He recovered, he went home, and the country's been officially declared Ebola-free. But as I found when I visited Senegal, Ebola still risks destroying the lives and livelihoods of many citizens. Not because of the disease itself, but because fear of the disease is driving people away. Breakfast time at the Lamantin Beach Hotel. The buffet here offers you a wide selection. Smoked fish, cold meats, tropical fruit. There's even three different kinds of pancake to choose from. They really are trying to keep tourists happy here. But right now, there's hardly anyone around to appreciate all the effort, because for the last few months, Senegal's resorts have seen one booking after another being cancelled. It's deeply frustrating for staff here, like Joseph Diouf.
People cancelled because of Ebola. Even some of our guests who are coming every year are not willing to come this year. And normally the hotel is full with kids, you know, running guests around the pool.
Did you try to reason with tourists and agencies? Did you say, look, there was only one case of Ebola a couple of months ago and it's been cured and there is no Ebola in Senegal?
Yes, we tried. But in fact, we have the impression people would not distinguish between Senegal or Sierra Leone or Guinea. It's sad.
There really is an awful sense here of emptiness and inactivity, of plans and preparations gone to waste. It's kind of like being in an English seaside town out of season. Except that we're not out of season. This is exactly when Senegalese resorts should be full, particularly with Europeans escaping the onset of winter. But it's clear those tourists have either stayed at home or taken their holidays elsewhere.
They have Ebola in Spain, in America. Why people are not afraid to go in this country, because maybe we are in Africa, everybody are afraid.
I met Kiki Ngoma sitting by the hotel pool. She works on guest relations at the hotel, a job she says she really needs, not just for herself, but for all the other people who depend on her income.
The money I get here, it's for my family, because in Africa, in Senegal particularly, you must pay for your father, your mama. I have to give the money.
So what happens if you or the other people working in tourism in this area, what happens if you lose your jobs because there are no tourists?
It's a big problem for me and for my family, what we can do.
And this is a bad time for people in Senegal to be facing that question. The country's other main earner, fishing, is also in trouble, with foreign trawlers hoovering up fish stocks, wiping out jobs in the process. Tourism was supposed to replace some of that lost employment. A tenth of the country's workforce now depend on it. So, although Senegal may have seen off Ebola, fear of the disease alone is enough to threaten the local economy. Aliou Fay is manager at a Senegal think tank, the Centre for the Study of Policy.
Tourism is not just one product, it's a bunch of products. Tourists buy food, they buy handicraft items, they go to some cultural activities. So if you have tourism slowdown, it reflects on all these sectors, agriculture, fishing, people working in these services. These will be affected.
Well, this is another place where jobs have been lost because of Ebola. This is Dakar's so-called Guinea market, a pretty ramshackle collection of stores where you can buy just about anything. And where many of the stallholders, many of the shoppers, come from Guinea, Senegal's southern neighbour, where Ebola has already killed more than 1,000 people. Now, Senegal's response to Ebola was to seal the border with Guinea. But that, at a stroke, wiped out the jobs of many people here, who used to make a living transporting passengers and products between the two countries. And you can see them here just sitting around watching the market, but with nothing to do.
Avant Ebola, notre business marchait très fort.
Before Ebola, our business was going very well. We used to take people as well as goods like clothes and shoes. Now, our business is no longer going. Because of Ebola, we cannot move. We will have to wait until they open the border. Then we will start working again.
Also at the market was Aliou Sharif Aydara. He came here from Guinea 4 years ago. He says he settled in very quickly. But the outbreak of Ebola back in his homeland has meant that Aliou is now exposed to new hostility. Prejudice about the disease, it seems, can come from within Senegal as well as without.
Right now in Senegal, if you go and find work somewhere, you are a Guinean, they will say, oh, you have Ebola, oh, you have Ebola. So to have work in Senegal now, you are a Guinean, is very little difficult.
But hold on, you've been here for 4 years, but you're saying people are still worried that you might have Ebola because you're from Guinea.
Yeah, you have some people that treat me like that, but I don't have Ebola, so it's very difficult. We just try to do more about it.
The authorities here in Senegal are making efforts to discourage this kind of prejudice. To ensure that the facts about Ebola are distinguished from the fiction, there are ads on television every night explaining how you can catch Ebola and how you can't. And you see posters with very graphic pictures explaining the disease for those who are unable to read. The images appropriately explicit for the message they convey. Avoid people's vomit, their feces and urine. Wash your hands. Don't kiss any corpses. I visited Senegal's Department of Health to speak with a minister here, Dr. Awa Marie Kolsek. She's won plaudits internationally for this country's response to Ebola. The secret, she told me, is recognizing the breadth of the challenge as well as its severity.
A disease for me is not only a medical issue, it's a problem of other specialties, particularly anthropologists, psychologists. When you look at Ebola, we need the Ministry of Education to give them information. And we need also to know that transport, like all the drivers coming from all over, need to understand what are the symptoms. It's really an issue. Everybody can play his role.
And everybody now includes Senegal's tourism agency, working, of course, not to prevent the actual spread of Ebola, but to mitigate its economic damage. I caught up with Uma Dia, the agency's marketing director, as she got ready for a tourism trade show. She beamed broadly, in that way people do when they're promoting a product. But the smile faded when I asked her about the tourists no longer visiting Senegal because of Ebola. She sees this as an outright injustice, the result of ignorance. But worst of all, she told me, it also feels like a very old story.
Some foreigners, wherever there is Ebola, for them it's one country, Africa. I mean, this is not new. Ebola is just one example. Africa has often been perceived as where nothing good happens. Sooner or later, Africa being stigmatized will have to stop.
Uma Dia from Senegal's tourism agency. In those countries still suffering from Ebola, tourism is not a central part of the economy. The mainstay of most people's lives is agriculture. But here, once again, the disease represents a serious threat. And once again, fear of Ebola is part of the problem. While I was in Senegal, I visited the regional headquarters for the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. Their deputy coordinator, Patrick David, told me how food production and rural incomes are now threatened at a regional level and right down to the individual household.
The household who has been affected by a death of one or more people now are not in position to work anymore. So they are not in position to maintain the field and to harvest. And this household face a real dire situation. For example, in Liberia, those who lost husband and brother has real difficulties to access to food, to get food, because they cannot harvest anymore.
And yet we know that this problem of food scarcity, of households not able to grow enough, it goes beyond those households immediately affected by Ebola.
Yes, actually, it's very important to understand in the three most Ebola-affected countries, people used to work in group for farming, especially for planting, for weeding, and for harvesting. At the beginning of the outbreak, there have been a lot of messages from the authorities not to be together, not to form group to stop the spread of the disease. And some people decided not to do anything. So they were discouraged to harvest. So in these places, in these areas, for example, in Sierra Leone, we've noticed people were definitely discouraged to work in the rice field where the rice is produced through irrigation. And the majority of the fields were abandoned. So that will have an impact of the food production, the rice production in this community.
Listening to you, it feels like even if by some miracle the Ebola outbreak was brought very quickly under control, you would still be left with huge lasting problems if the harvest has been missed and if now the future planting is going to be affected in the way you've described.
Definitely, there will be an impact on the agriculture and livelihoods. There will be a need to be sure that the farmers will have access to quality seeds. Otherwise, there will be an increase of food insecurity and malnutrition and poverty.
Patrick David from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. So, agriculture, tourism, the economy generally. Ebola has affected all aspects of personal and national life. And that includes football. Morocco had made great preparations for hosting the Africa Cup of Nations Football Championship this coming January. But the authorities there decided there was too much risk of fans and players bringing Ebola into the country. They refused to hold the contest on time and have now seen it given instead to Equatorial Guinea. Meanwhile, Guinea itself, which has Ebola, was allowed to play all its games away. And this week, Guinea was celebrating after it qualified for the finals. So too did Ghana. And that provided an opportunity to explore the widely differing attitudes people have towards Ebola. I went to a local sports bar here in Ghana's capital, Accra, as the national team were playing. People watching the match seemed more divided over Morocco's decision than they were over the performance of their team.
I thought it was a bad decision because the African Cup brings us together. We all watch football. In Africa, we lack football. So Ebola is a very dangerous disease. But I think it's panic.
What do you think of the decision by Morocco not to host the championship?
It's a good decision that the Moroccans have taken because we have our lives at stake. This disease hasn't got a proper cure. So for Morocco taking that decision, I think it's the right channel.
You wouldn't go and see the championship now if you could. If you could go to Equatorial Guinea, you would stay away.
Definitely. Even if I have free options to go and watch it, I'm not going. I would rather watch it on television or anything else.
How about you, sir? What do you think of Morocco's decision?
For me, I'm very happy that they've withdrawn because football is always there, but life is not always there.
So do you think Equatorial Guinea made a bad decision saying they would take over and host the championship?
For me, it's a bad decision, but if they have their reason why they did that, fine, it's up to them. But for me, it's a bad decision.
Would you go to the championship if you could, if I offered you a free ticket?
Trust me, I would never go. I love my life.
The African Cup of Nations is where all Africans come together. Ebola has brought division. Even now in our churches, we cannot even shake.
You can't shake hands?
We can shake hands because we are all afraid. We are all afraid. You can't even hug your fellow man just because of Ebola. Why should it be so? Why should it be so?
Voices from a sports bar in Accra. You're listening to Ebola, The Impact on Africa with me, Paul Moss, on the BBC World Service. We'll take a short break now, but after the news, there'll be more from Ghana. We'll hear from the doctor who hopes never to have a patient. I ask Ghana's foreign minister if her country and others in Africa are doing enough to support Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone. And we'll hear the views of the legendary Senegalese musician Baba Mal. All that in a couple of minutes.
The BBC World Service.
We have the headlines.
Democracy protests have spread to new parts of Hong Kong.
But we go further.
I am on a pedestrian walkway looking down into the sea of people that have taken to the streets here. People as far as the eye can see, thousands of them.
Telling it how it is.
I'm right on the border between Turkey and Syria, and within the last few minutes, two very large explosions heard just a few hundred meters from where we were standing.
Giving people a voice.
I tried to stay positive, although I was scared when I saw my relatives dying in front of me.
Looking to the future.
The Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has appealed to all countries to help fight the Ebola virus.
It is the duty of all of us to send a message that we will not leave millions of West Africans to fend for themselves.
The BBC World Service, the world's radio station.
I'm Paul Moss in Ghana's capital, Accra, and I'm here to report on the wider effects of the Ebola crisis in Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone, and across West Africa. What does it mean for this region's economy and people's faith in their governments? And what does it tell us if many of the world's tourists and business people now seem to be shunning Africa as a whole because of Ebola fears? Join me for Ebola, the Impact on Africa, in a couple of minutes after the news.
BBC News with David Austin. Official sources in Washington say President Obama has ordered American forces to continue some aspects of their mission in Afghanistan in 2015, even though U.S. combat operations were officially due to finish by the end of this year. The sources say the president has authorized U.S. troops to fight militant groups and to offer air and ground support for Afghan forces. As talks in Vienna on Iran's nuclear program enter their final stages, there are growing doubts that a deadline set for Monday will be met or that a deal will be struck. The US, Britain, France and other world powers are seeking to curb Iran's nuclear activities in return for easing international sanctions. The police in Kenya say they're on the trail of the Islamist militants who killed 28 people on a bus in northeast Kenya. The Somali group Al-Shabaab admitted carrying out the attack, in which those who could not recite verses from the Quran were shot in the head. The Gulf monarchy of Bahrain has been holding its first parliamentary election since pro-democracy demonstrations there were crushed 3 years ago. Opposition parties from the majority Shia Muslim community continue to demand that the Sunni establishment eases its grip on power, and they called for a boycott. The Colombian president, Juan Manuel Santos, says the FARC rebel group will free an army general and several other captives next week. Their seizure a week ago led to the suspension of long-running government peace talks with the rebels. Thousands of Catholic pilgrims are converging on Goa on India's west coast to see the relics of the 16th century Spanish missionary St. Francis Xavier. The event only takes place every 10 years. And a watercolour by Adolf Hitler has fetched $161,000 at an auction in the German city of Nuremberg. It was bought by an individual from the Middle East. Some auction houses refused to sell Hitler's works. BBC News.
Welcome back to the Ghanaian capital, Accra. I'm Paul Moss, and you're listening to a special programme, Ebola, The Impact on Africa. In the next half hour, we'll hear from Guinea, from Sierra Leone, and we'll get the views of politicians, commentators and activists from around West Africa. Accra is the centre for the United Nations mission to tackle Ebola. But are African governments themselves doing enough to support those countries which have the disease? The musician Baba Mal tells us they could be doing more. Here in Ghana, of course, there have been no Ebola cases, but they're not taking any chances. Arriving at the airport, I was met by a medic who checked my temperature and all the other passengers before we were allowed into the country. They're also building dedicated Ebola treatment facilities, just in case there is an outbreak. My colleague Tim Mansell went to see one.
A 40-minute drive down the motorway from Accra is the city of Tema, and in the grounds of the sprawling General Hospital, slightly set apart from the other buildings, is a long, white, tent-like construction made of plastic. This is Tema's Ebola Treatment Centre. So, tell me your name, please.
Kwame Safo.
You helped design this facility?
Yes.
Okay, Kwame, well, why don't we go and have a look?
Yeah, sure, let's go in. Yeah. Now we're ready to enter the infected zone. So you can now push this way.
And so we've pushed through the door. We're now in the main ward.
Exactly.
And the door's closed.
Yes.
And we can't leave through that door.
No exit. You know, it's written here, no exit. So once you get in here, it means you're done. You don't have to go back. Your only way out is through here.
It's a long room, 20 meters or so, 10 meters wide, two rows of beds. The beds are just very simple wooden frames with mattresses all covered in plastic. Nobody has been in any of these beds.
From this unit, then you would go out through this door where you decontaminate.
Leaving the main ward now, and this is the decontamination chamber. Let's go through.
Yeah, so you can actually, with your arm, push it. And you are in here.
Oh, I see. That's really interesting. So you just lean on the door and push it. So
you don't touch anything.
You don't touch anything at all.
Yeah. Yes.
So every door you go through, you push your way through. You never pull a handle.
No, you don't do that. You push. Although you don't pull any door.
The man in charge of this new Ebola treatment facility is Dr. Lawrence Ofori Bwadu. He's sitting in front of me in very smart grey scrubs from the University of Michigan, which is where he did his internship. And like all good doctors, he's got a stethoscope around his neck. What do your friends and family say when you tell them that you are now in charge of the Ebola treatment facility?
Well, definitely nobody's happy because they see Ebola as a deadly disease that is highly infectious. Family-wise, my wife, children, say, oh, Daddy, I mean, it's so risky. Why do you want to take this risk job? And I tell them it's part of my work. So I'm being very careful, you know, but I keep on encouraging that we have to be on board. I don't regret being part of the team. I don't regret a bit at all.
Before I came down to Tema, I'd read some newspaper articles that said that the local people around here weren't very happy that an Ebola treatment centre was being built so close to them. There's a row of businesses here opposite the hospital, so I'm going to test opinion.
I think it's very good. Yeah, it's there to help us in case there is an emergency. The person can be treated as soon as possible.
Well, I think it's a good thing. It's really a good thing because we don't have to wait for it to come before we begin fighting it.
And you have no concern about it being so close to all these businesses?
In fact, if the medical center is close to the people, it's the best.
I thought it's dangerous because this disease travels a lot. So it's not safe. I don't like the idea.
Ghana is a rich country compared to Guinea, Liberia or Sierra Leone. Its health service, for example, is in far better shape. But it's a health service that's constantly being stretched. Malaria is ever present here, tuberculosis is a major problem, and the country is still dealing with its worst outbreak of cholera for 30 years. The Deputy Health Minister is Victor Asare Bampo.
We have a health service that is doing its best to bring down some of the burden of disease. So malaria is going down. HIV has gone down significantly. You know, it's, I think, 1.3% or so, you know. So we're doing pretty okay. So we, you know, for Ebola to come would then stretch us even more. But we're taking very seriously the training, you know, getting everything in place to make sure that in the unlikely event that we have a case of Ebola, we're able to deal with it robustly to emulate what Senegal and Nigeria have done.
The minister told me that 120 people had been tested in Ghana for Ebola this year, all of them negative. As well as the treatment centre in Tema, they're building three others in the centre and north of the country. Ghanaians will be crossing their fingers that none of these centres ever admits a patient.
Tim Ansell reporting. So Ghana clearly making plenty of preparation, just in case Ebola should strike. But what about its efforts to help other countries where the disease is already a reality? Earlier in the programme, we heard from a new charity formed here, giving ordinary Ghanaians the opportunity to help send relief supplies. But when I spoke to Ghana's Foreign Minister, Hannah Tete, she admitted that governments in this region had not been so quick to help out.
I must admit that when the incidence of Ebola occurred in Guinea, we saw it as a Guinean problem. And so even though there was sympathy and there was, you know, expressions of solidarity and thinking of how we could support, nobody thought that it would get to the point at which it is now. Then it spread quickly from Guinea to Liberia to Sierra Leone. And then we realized that, no, this is really something that is becoming very drastic and we need to work together to be able to address it.
What are you doing as a country to help those countries that have got Ebola?
We agreed that we would be the logistics hub for the Ebola missions. The UN mission, we didn't stop that from flying in and out because we thought it was important.
Okay, you haven't stopped aid flights going in, but what I'm asking is what Ghana itself has done other than allowing the UN to operate out of here.
As far as medical personnel are concerned, we are understaffed ourselves and therefore are not in a position to ask medical workers to volunteer to go to the Ebola-affected countries because simply we don't have enough staff to be able to take care of our own.
But here in Accra and in other cities in Ghana, you do have some of the best medical facilities that exist across Africa. This country is one of the wealthiest countries in Africa. Is this not an opportunity to show a bit of regional solidarity and send some people who could go and help out?
We don't have the medical personnel to help out. When you say Ghana have some of the best hospitals in West Africa, I agree, but it's relative. And a lot of the medical facilities you see here in Accra are private. The public medical facilities, the numbers, even for the doctors we have here, are extremely strenuous.
You see, what some critics have said, and I mean critics within Africa, is that Ebola could have been an opportunity for African countries that are developing fast to show that they can do things, that they can help themselves and help each other, rather than depending on the United Nations, the United States, the United Kingdom.
Do you know how many of our qualified doctors moved to the UK and the United States? And Ghana is not the only African country that is affected by that, because for most English-speaking African countries, a great number of our trained medical personnel, who we train here at the taxpayers' cost, go to help you.
Ghana's Foreign Minister, Hanna Tete. There's no doubt that Ebola does spread more rapidly where doctors and nurses are thin on the ground, and that this lack of healthcare is a result of poverty. But as we said earlier in the programme, Ebola can itself be a factor that makes poverty more serious. Take Guinea, for example, where the current outbreak began. It was already one of the poorest countries on the continent, with very limited industry, completely dependent on trade for many day-to-day items which need to be imported. But what business community there is in Guinea is now struggling to keep going.
My name is Sulaiman Kamara, and I'm a businessman in Guinea, Conakry. I am in the garment business. I go to Hong Kong, I go to China, and in China, I go to Guangzhou. Like a couple of years I've been going there, and I have so many partners. We buy ladies' dresses. We buy men jeans, ladies jeans, whatever we see on the market, we just go for it. Our customers usually come from Sierra Leone, Liberia, but since the outbreak of the Ebola, people are no more coming here. People are just too scared. I wanted to go to China, but because of the Ebola, they have restricted a lot of Guineans from here to go to China, because I had a one-year visa. The visa just expired, but they can't issue me visa for now. They don't care about who has Ebola or not, because they are not taking the right measures to check who has Ebola or who doesn't have Ebola. They're not giving visa almost to everybody. Everybody from Guinea, people want to go, but they can't go. I'm losing money. I'm not making money no more, because the propaganda of the Ebola is so much. I'm not making money, or all my friends around me are not making money too, because everybody's just crying.
That phrase, the propaganda of Ebola, is one that would certainly be recognised by people here in Ghana. Despite having no Ebola cases, business people I've spoken to say that investors have cancelled their visits to Ghana, trade and academic delegations too, people apparently unwilling to go anywhere in West Africa. Indeed, there are reports of people cancelling visits to East and South Africa, thousands of miles from the nearest Ebola case. So what can be done when people apparently lump together Liberia and Kenya, Sierra Leone and South Africa? Are we really back to the days when it was all just seen as the dark continent? To discuss this and the other issues raised by the Ebola outbreak, we brought together a panel of commentators here in the Ghanaian capital. Jacob Gordon is a historian and Kwame Nkrumah professor at Ghana University's Institute of African Studies. He comes originally from Nigeria. Nana Ama Ajiman is a Ghanaian journalist. And Silas Siaka is a campaigner on various environmental and social issues back in his home country, Liberia. We met at Afrikiko, a well-known venue in this city for people to eat, drink and chew over issues of the day. I first asked Silas Siaka about Liberia, because it was this country that some feared would come off worst from the Ebola outbreak. There were predictions it might fall apart completely. But in fact, he told us, Liberia has proved rather more resilient.
Well, every other day I speak to friends, relatives back in Monrovia, they all seem to be very hopeful. They all kind of suggest that things have started to improve, and improve rapidly.
What sort of things are they saying they're seeing that makes them feel that perhaps a corner is being turned?
For example, most of the colleagues that I speak to who have been out in the countryside distributing sanitation materials and other basic things that people need just to keep safe, they have seen a gradual change in people's response to them. They have seen rapid decline in the number of instances where people were sick and trying to find hospitals to go to.
Liberia has often been described as a state that's almost a failed state, recovering from a war like Sierra Leone. Why do you think they have been able to perhaps maybe not turn the situation around completely, but show these signs of improvement?
I think we all have to realize that when this crisis started, a lot of people, including myself, thought of it very much as a health crisis. But as time went along, everybody began to realize that there was a need for everyone to get involved one way or the other. So journalists were being challenged to do their part. Those that were in development communications, for example, were being asked to do their part. So raising awareness about the Ebola itself. So we had a very mass level of civic engagement in all of this. The population decided that this is not just about the Minister of Health, workers in the health sector. This is about the population.
Nana Amajiman, we've heard a lot, obviously, about what the West has done, what international organizations like the United Nations have done to tackle Ebola. This kind of civil engagement that Silas is describing, is that going on sufficiently in the countries that have Ebola? Are we missing this, or is it still lacking in most places?
I think that it's probably going on. It's just not reported much. Africa is perceived as a place where people can't do anything for themselves. We need Westerners to come in and help us. It's partly true because our governments haven't been that great in putting in the proper structures, because first of all, we shouldn't even be suffering from Ebola. That's what I think.
Professor Gordon, is this a matter of the way the story is reported, the image of Africa, as Nana Ama suggested, or is there also, as she said, the problem that there just isn't the governance there to deal with this problem?
It's all of the above. It's governance, it's how the West looks at Africa, how Africans themselves look at themselves, and the whole culture of dependency. It's all of the above. It's everything. If we had effective African leadership, there'll be no Ebola. There'll be no malaria diseases. There'll be no ignorance. There'll be no poverty. But we have not got there. We all got independence more than half a century ago. And Africa is very wealthy, is very rich, and yet is the poorest continent in the world. Why? Because of people who are running Africa. Because of leadership. We don't have transformational leadership.
And yet there was this talk of this perhaps rather glib phrase, Africa rising, suggesting in particular that there was a new generation of African leaders emerging in some countries. Many of them were being invited by Tony Blair in Britain, by President Obama.
Well, I know about the program. Why should Obama even do that for Africa? Why can't the other leaders do it for Africa? We have many leaders who are in Africa who could have done that, but they won't do that.
Can I ask you, Nana Amajiman, it may sound absurd to talk about positive outcomes from something as horrific as Ebola, but do you think these issues that we're talking about are being noticed and that out of this there may come some kind of progress, some kind of awareness of what needs doing?
Oh, I think that there are positives to this. We haven't recorded any disease in Ghana, but we've had a conversation. We're having a running conversation about it. We're making demands of our government. It's so intensive that the Ministry of Health had to take journalists to go and see a holding center. So I think it's good that Ebola happened. It's just drawn our attention that, okay, there's something wrong here. We can't just sit idle. We need to start putting in measures to save all of us. So not just for Ebola, but, you know, maternal death, cholera, and other diseases. I think that's the best part of it.
We talked about the image of Africa. I mean, we heard earlier people who seem to confuse Senegal and Sierra Leone, people who are avoiding. I mean, I've heard of people who aren't going to Tanzania and Kenya because of Ebola, despite them being thousands of miles from the nearest case. Can I ask you, Silas Siako, is it possible to change that kind of image to perhaps educate the wider world about where Africa is and what kind of continent it is?
Yes, it is possible. And again, we can go back to the crisis in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone to draw some lessons from there. When the crisis started, the media, the reportage was very much about ignorance, superstition, myth around Ebola was driving the spread. By August in Liberia, the situation was getting very much out of control. The cases were multiplying and people were getting sick. They were going to the hospitals, they were going to the quarantine centers, but there were no beds to take them in. But the media wasn't focusing on that, the fact that the infrastructure was lacking. They weren't picking that up. I think those of us on the continent have a responsibility. We need to project the positive image, the positive elements of our situation, and build on those positive things in order to improve our situation.
But even when you do that, there's a mindset of a group of people in this world against people of color. You can't change your mindset. Africans, black folks are inherently inferior. It's difficult to change that mindset.
I do agree that some people are always going to think black and colored people
yes.
are inferior. There are always going to be people like that. But shouldn't we work to the point where we're not begging for handouts? Shouldn't our leaders be active and stop begging for aid and stop buying vehicles and getting on the ground and delivering schools and hospitals?
I agree. 100%.
But then can I ask you, do you see enough of that coming from a grassroots level? People, we heard about those people in Ghana who've mobilized themselves, even if Africa doesn't have the kind of leadership that Professor Gordon would like to see.
I think the citizens are getting out there and doing things for themselves. That's the most exciting part of what I do. I'm a journalist, so I get to hear stories of young people starting businesses, young people grouping together and raising funds and doing things for communities. There was a school that was painted in a village outside the Ashanti region recently. It was citizens that went out and did that for themselves.
But have we seen enough of that in the fight against Ebola?
I don't think so. I get upset when I heard that Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg donated $25 million towards Ebola research and for a cure. And up until that point, none of the richest people on this continent had said anything about, you know, contributing, donating, even just materials or gloves or anything. Nobody had said anything up until that point. Nobody has, even since then, they've come out to say, oh, they're donating, I don't know, $5 million. I haven't seen it. I haven't seen any action. Nobody is organizing a group of people from the countries that are not affected to go to these countries to help out.
Sada Siako, have you seen anything, heard of anything that makes you feel that there are people out there, perhaps rich Africans, who are doing something in this struggle?
There are a lot of rich people on the continent, and we think that they could spend a lot of their wealth that has been generated from the continent one way or the other to also help the population on the continent. We should not have to rely on the Bill Gates in order to help deal with our crisis on the continent.
Silas Siako, Nana Ama Ajiman, and Jacob Gordon. Well, now we turn to Sierra Leone and a British teacher who's been helping to deal with Ebola and its consequences. Miriam Mason-Sasse had already been in Sierra Leone for 14 years, running a group of schools there with 3,000 pupils. But when Ebola broke out, all schools in Sierra Leone were closed as an emergency measure. So Miriam decided to work instead protecting the health of her pupils, rather than just their educational needs. You may have heard her describe some of her experiences on BBC Radio. But what she now fears will be the longest lasting consequence of Ebola is the number of orphans that it's left behind. Indeed, if by some miracle Ebola were to disappear tomorrow, the country would still be left with a major orphan crisis. Miriam described the situation in the Port Loko region where she lives, a couple of hours' drive north of the Sierra Leone capital, Freetown.
Ebola crept closer and closer, and then it just went mad. And every day now there are 20, 30 new cases. One particular chiefdom that has been horribly afflicted is Lokomasama, and it's taking 2 days to get an ambulance, 2-3 days to get a burial team. And I mean, one village, they've lost 31 adults in 3 weeks. Everybody's focus has been obviously initially on just treating the people that have Ebola, but one of the massive problems is going to be the fact that there are thousands now of orphans. You know, lots and lots of youngsters effectively on the streets, having nobody to feed them, nobody to care for them. So while we are not going to be able to take in thousands, we are trying to see how many we can take. And the trick is to do that safely at this time when there's still such high levels of infection. If we're talking about an orphan who's lost their parents within the last 21 days, then they are very, very likely to still be at risk of infection themselves. So it's about providing for that situation safely. It'll be partitions. We've got a well. We're digging latrines. It's pretty simple, basic concrete structure. And then as quickly as we can, we will provide them with a long-term solution where they will have a family and a future. And we'll start being able to provide them with education. There are many, many more children in need than there are places to take them in. So at the moment, we're not keeping up. At the moment, there are many, many children on the streets. There are situations where they're being sort of corralled into a house and maybe they're getting some food a little bit, but they're mixing infected children with not infected children, and so it spreads. In some areas, you've got nobody really stepping in. Two little ones I heard about yesterday, they both tested negative for Ebola, but their mother had Ebola, and they ended up going with her into the treatment center. What's the likelihood they stay negative? That sort of horrible situation where there's just nobody to take care is far too common.
Miriam Mason-Sasse speaking from Port Loko in Sierra Leone. And that's it from this special programme, Ebola, the Impact on Africa, with me, Paul Moss, in Ghana. The producer was Tim Mansell. Technical production was by Jacques Sweeney. We're going to leave you with words and music from one of Africa's greatest singers, Senegal's Baba Mal. Despite his considerable international fame, Baba Mal has tended to keep away from politics. But the spread of Ebola seems to have fired him up with a determination to make his opinion known on this issue at least.
We are living in a time where Africa is the future. Africa have a lot of resources. You've seen China coming here to do business. Some other countries are from the West, from Europe, are trying to do business. It's not a long time ago we saw Barack Obama organizing to call in Washington all these young African leaders. But all of that, suddenly because of Ebola, suddenly because all of this problem, that have to stop. All of that is something that suddenly because of Ebola, we're going to need another restart, you know. It's not nice to say, but we have so many people who went in the West to study medicine, who are doctors, who are nurses from Africa, and most of these people stay. Everyone should be coming back to help Africa to go away from Ebola. If you are really concerned about the future of Africa and you know that you can't help, you should come back to help. Most of these countries who are affected by Ebola are left on their own so far. I didn't hear that, sending doctors and things to from the African countries. I didn't hear that yet. It has to start by a collaboration between African governments, African peoples. Maybe I'm wrong, but I would have liked to see that. No one can avoid the fact that poverty is still here. The lack of education is still here. Ebola is just near your door. And maybe if we go away from Ebola, the next step should be to push a lot of education, especially education for the women who are just in the centers of the families. Really, when diseases like that happen, they are the one who really take care about the children. The Minister of Health in Senegal is a woman, and she did good with Ebola. And we're starting to see women, more and more women like that in several countries in Africa. And I think this is why I say I'm more optimistic for this continent.